Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in the January-February issue. For more, see www.computer.org/security or www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the seventh in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very happy to have with me here today, John Stewart. Hi, John.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for having me today.
John is the CSO of Cisco, which is a small business weighing in at $22 billion, and he's a well-known security guru. He was previously came up through the ranks of Digital Island, where he started as Director of Systems Engineering and became the CSO. DI was eventually acquired by Cable and Wireless back in the dot-com days. John is the co-author of the WWW Security FAQ for those old-timers in the audience. He lives in California with his wife, Rhonda, and two kids, Jonathan and Nicole, and he does not own a kilt. Sorry about that, John.
Thanks a lot, Gary. I'm sure I'll have to buy one as a result.
So the first question is, what exactly does a CSO do?
Well, some days it feels like a CSO is just a manager, which is, you know, the day-to-day activity can include the fact that I've got employees, the fact that we've got budgets, the fact that we've got, personnel situations or growing a management team. And so at a very basic level, I think one of the roles that I think most CSOs are playing is building talent so that fundamentally they don't have to be critical path. At the same time, there are unique positions depending on which industry or company you're at. In my particular position, a second set of responsibilities includes being a straightforward but honest advocate of security for how Cisco is doing it, what our overall thinking process is in this industry at the moment, how it's moving, changing, altering. And that's, I think, largely unique based on which company or the role of the company is in the industry. And so it's partially unique just to me, given Cisco's role here. And then at a more technological level or a business and technology blend, it's bringing the topic up as a huge cheerleader. It is certainly a topic I've been very passionate and enjoyed being in and a part of for coming up on too many years that I won't admit, given your kilt comment earlier.
Oh, come on, you can tell.
And it becomes one of those things where you're just trying to make it a mainstream topic inside of the company. So it becomes the internal advocate for the topic.
So you certainly started out your career as a very deep technologist and quite a good one at that. And you've morphed over the years into this kind of business/technology balancing act. What kind of advice would you give to somebody who wanted to do that sort of thing for a career path?
I think the best experience I had, and it can be applied differently, but I'll explain mine that really helped me bridge it, was helping build a company from scratch, you know, all the way up to having sold it.
That was Digital Island, right?
And we're talking about Digital Island, exactly. That experience really filled in a lot of gaps for me when it came to business side. It certainly taught me a lot about finance, about corporate positioning, about a marketing program, about customers, about customer orientation and how you need to constantly, you know, focus on their needs, how to talk to an executive team, how to talk to a board, how to talk to investors as we took the company public and we were talking with either, private or public investment and our analyst community and press. And just all those experiences helped me understand that from what I largely understood security to be, which was a technology discussion in so many ways, that it had to change and morph to various audiences. But more importantly, I think it got me very seasoned, painfully at times and with a lot of bumps and bruises for me personally, just having to learn so much on the business side.
Right.
And what it made and what it took.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really interesting balance, and the more security evolves, the more we're going to need people who can kind of work on both sides of that line. So you got your MS in computer and information systems from Syracuse long ago, and you're not
gonna, Orangeman.
You're not going to disclose how long ago. But how did you get started in computer security coming with a CIS degree?
This is one of those classic timing is everything kind of things. So I went to Syracuse, and you can do the math because you can look up the history, and I'm sure you remember it right in the back of your head, right when the Morris Worm launched.
Ah, yes.
And it so happened
1988.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate you educating everybody now.
No problem.
So I was at Syracuse at the time, and being just north of Cornell University, not only literally, but also at that time electronically, we were one of the first locations that got to enjoy that worm being launched.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, no one at the time really knew what it was. And so we were all in a very interesting firefight / learning mode. But it was an interesting topic. And then the trial occurred in Syracuse, New York.
Did it really? I didn't know
it
that.
It did.
Wow.
And so that made it an interesting topic in the city for a while. But with that as a backdrop, probably the single most important situation or opportunity that really got me turned on to this was when, and I'm sure you'll crack up at this because you can see it in your own head, having you and I having known each other for so long. I was sitting as a grad student at Syracuse, and I was sitting in a backroom office where grad students would largely be kept to keep them away from the public. and I had three-letter agencies and international agencies explaining to me that they wanted to know why Syracuse University was breaking into the United States Air Force Technology Center down in Texas.
Because you guys were a jumping off point.
We are a jumping off point. And it started me down the road. So
there, you know, there's an important lesson there, which is never trust Cornell.
I'm sure there's something to be said there, except my sister being a graduate of Cornell, I have to trust it implicitly.
I'll have to tell Fred Schneider that.
Thanks. But, you know, it was a really eye-opening experience as a grad student, and that really got me interested. It's an enormous game of chess where there's how do you keep one step ahead of your opponent, certainly at a technology basis. It was largely a new industry, and being a curious type, it is the one that sort of dragged me at a very, 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 very high level, and just it's been everything downhill since.
Yeah, it's great. So you've probably perceived this shift over that period from security as sort of a protection / configuration network infrastructure issue more towards security engineering. Is that something that you think the world is finally catching on to, or am I just crazy?
I would say the world really wants to catch on to it. I can't really break it down as to whether or not we've caught on to it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm sort of being somewhat circular in referencing it that way is because I think it's moved into a mainstream topic, but it's even up to you and I talking today, it's too broad a word.
Right.
So it's interpreted in so many different ways, and net of it is that there is not enough leveling yet on a structured way of thinking it through so that every organization can truly adopt it the way you and I were just talking about a second ago.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Do you think that this movement that you've talked about in past work and other interviews, this movement from computer security as annoyance, like attacks that were just sort of annoying and a pain in the wazoo, towards computer security attacks as theft and as actual crime that costs money will help to push security engineering, or does that just make security writ large a bigger thing? Is there any correlation there?
I think there's a correlation to what you just said, which is there's a value equation that has been brought in that is slightly different than it used to be. But I think there's also the fact that the quote-unquote IT systems of so many companies have become things that are relied upon as opposed to useful. And I think if you take it as a timeline, those two in parallel, it's why so much of this discussion is now come to bear today in sort of in today's age, if you will.
So, so I guess you could say then the discipline has moved from maybe the land of plumbers, where we make sure that the pipes are put together properly and the water's flowing, to more of a strategic importance, where it's critical to the business to make sure security gets done properly.
Yeah, I could say it that way, except my father-in-law is a plumber, and I really, really like my water running.
There's nothing wrong with plumbers.
I
mean,
but I
plumbers
guess
are necessary.
What I was joking was about was the fact that, you know, as an interesting parallel, when the network went down, you know, 5-8 years ago, mm-hmm. And maybe now, of course, getting to be longer, it was not such an impact to businesses as it is now.
Right.
And it, by the way, being at Cisco, we're very happy about that in one way of looking at it.
Well, absolutely. You guys provide critical infrastructure to keep it going.
But at the same time, the motivation of the threat has moved where, you know, if you've got something in your house, Gary, that's worth $1 million and I can spend $100,000 to get it, the return on investment for me stealing it is pretty high.
Right.
So instead of just trying to make the newspaper and, you know, write the fastest worm out there, it's now, how do I, in fact, not write the fastest worm? How do I get in without you noticing mm-hmm. and take something valuable? Mm-hmm. And I'm financed to do it.
So that's a new way of thinking like a bad guy. As the bad guys evolve, we have to continue to figure out what they're trying to do, why they're trying to accomplish what they're doing.
Right, right. And it's largely in a way of also looking at a business basis.
Right.
You know, that which you have is valuable and I need it, and therefore I'll either work with you legitimately to get it or I'll steal it, but either way, it's still valuable.
So as the CSO, are you responsible for software security at Cisco?
Yes and no. And I'm imagining, Gary, that you're asking about particularly in our products.
No, not, well, maybe. You have tons of developers, and clearly they're building stuff every day. And you know my pet bugaboo is trying to get them to have a clue about security.
Absolutely.
And so, but in most organizations, really security is not pushing the agenda on the software security front.
So I wonder if
it is at Cisco. I just don't even know.
Yeah, and so in one way of thinking, excuse me, say for the IT development arm, and I'll largely separate that from the engineering development arm of Cisco. on the IT development arm, when I say I'm responsible, I would say it incorrectly. What I am guiding them is for they themselves to be responsible for it.
Gotcha.
And so, for example, we're putting in inside of quality assurance checks and inside of the development lifecycle of IT development, the security parameters for that lifecycle that you know far better than I do. Is so necessary to keep the results of the development lifecycle relatively pristine.
And do you think that the kind of IT's focus on that or attention to that will hop the fence over to products land?
Well, and so interestingly enough, I think it has already hopped there faster than it happened in IT.
Okay.
And I look to things both in industry as well as inside of our own company. And you know, certainly one example of the industry side is how Microsoft brought the secure development lifecycle in.
Yep.
As an attempt to change the way they develop to address some of the situations that we've seen in our past, respectively in industry.
Yeah, in fact, you know, plug for a previous silver bullet, the episode 6 is with Mike Howard, who's helping to roll that stuff out at Microsoft.
And by the way, I couldn't, you know, be more proud of them for taking it on, because it is a monolithic task.
Yep.
And it's just very difficult to do, but to change that culture, in my own mind, quickly is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in our product side here at Cisco, we are trailing them in the timeline, but we're going through the same level of awakening and then integration into development.
Yeah,
are going to be behind them scheduling-wise, but
Many companies are doing that right now,
yeah.
Especially in the financial vertical. It wouldn't surprise you to hear, I'm sure.
Right, and I think that's, you know, not surprisingly, I think every company is, again, trying to ensure that, you know, you build strong defense through development, just as you've been preaching, you know, and in fact, been one of the strongest advocates for many, many years. And it's only just now that that the topic is finally connecting to the timeline where it can be interpreted.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully it'll work. So this would not be a responsible and mean interview if I didn't ask you about Cisco Gate. You know, the 2 years ago thingy with Michael Lynn at Black Hat where you guys took lots of heat. And I know that you were out of the country at the time.
Yeah, recommendation, don't take a vacation during Black
Hat.
Yeah,
but you did a really great job kind of countering the bad publicity in February, I thought, and had some very good things to say. Did you go to Black Hat this year?
I did. In fact, I actually ensured that we were a platinum sponsor of the conference, and then I was there personally for 3 days, and we threw... As we were joking about it, we bought a beer for everybody on us, and we threw a bit of a bash over at the Red Room, and it was kind of ironic. And if you can picture the scene, it just so happened that Caesars was celebrating an anniversary, and I want to say it was its 40th. So you've got the very traditionally and somewhat stereotypically security people all dressed in black.
Right.
And then you've got a toga party going on at exactly the same time. Only in Las Vegas, exactly. So it was quite a juxtaposition of colors.
So did you see any talks or participate in any conversations that were noteworthy while you were at Black Hat?
Yeah, in fact, we with Dave Mortman's help and Nico Sells and a couple others, we actually ensured to bring... I think it was a grand total of 10 people onto a panel discussion about the previous summer's topic.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was, quote-unquote, responsible disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, Steve Lipner from Microsoft and I were two members. And then there were customers, and then there were independent researchers.
Mm-hmm.
So, like David Litchfield of the world, Raven was on for the network security part of the world. And then we had an audience of just heavy interaction and questions and answers moderated by David.
That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, it really was. And part of the reason that, and asking about Cisco Gate that you did, part of the reason was because in my mind, some of the best of intentions in the summer of 2005 came out as the worst results.
Yeah. Well, when the press gets a hold of stuff, they have a blast.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we made some of our own mistakes in handling it that we've learned from, which was it just came across wrong, and it's not the spirit of the company that was seen in the actions that were resulting and interpreted.
Yep.
And so I wanted to get out there, and we were somewhat faceless in 2005 as behind sort of PR spokespeople.
Yep.
Which sometimes weren't even named, and that's just by practice of how we handle those. But I wanted to get out there and go, you know, bring it on. You know, if we screwed up and you want to finally yell at somebody at Cisco because you got frustrated,
yeah,
I'm here.
Yeah.
And I'll take all the beating I need to, because I don't want the spirit of Cisco to be interpreted that way, because that's just not who we are.
You know, I think it worked. I think you did a very good job with that, actually.
So anyway, I in fact fully and genuinely enjoyed listening to people explain to me that which they saw,
mm-hmm,
and then ask questions. I bought Michael Lynn a beer, and FX, another person that's done a lot of research on Cisco Kit.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's, I think, dangerously
that's a very cheap,
so
cheap bribe, really.
I think there's a photograph of all of us hugging, but I hopefully that won't. It's probably on YouTube or on Google by now.
We'll see if we can dig that up for the website.
But it really was a good time, and it was trying to put to rest, or at least heal some of the wounds that were created, and I think we owned our own piece of that.
So there's been another time where you were sort of on the other side of the mirror, so to speak, when you were the victim of identity theft, apparently buying your wife a motorcycle.
No, actually, not buying it, but...
not buying it.
There was a funny story as a result, trying to buy one after I'd been the victim.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I was... California State DMV ended up, quote-unquote, losing my renewal driver license when they were sending it to me.
Aha.
And all of a sudden...
Somebody else got it.
Yeah, I had repaired a car in San Leandro, California, I was 6'5",
yeah,
weighed about 210, and was black.
And you had probably very short hair.
And had very short hair, and you know, in some respects, I think the guy possibly looked better than I did on this photo on his license, but we won't get into that. that started a chain of events that took the better part of about 18 months for me to unglue.
Do you think that the thieves were better off given the fact that there's so many John Stewarts out there in the world? Like, there was a Kingston Trio John Stewart and a congressman and some Scottish Earl. Wikipedia is just filled with...
None of which I am, unfortunately, in some ways. Like, the Scottish Earl part would be nice, but... I think it, yes, to a degree, but I think also because back in, certainly in those days, there were a number of things, including myself, even being in the security business, I didn't realize the depth of impact of security theft until I went through it. And so I was not taking the right steps. I was not pulling my credit twice a year.
Right.
And believe me, now I do.
Yeah. It's so interesting to be on the other side of that, you know, to find out what it's really like.
It was not fun, and so now it's just the largest advocate for just simple things like pull your credit twice a year. You know, it's a derivative thing that ensures that anything that's weird will trigger. And
right.
So, you know, and I did something very dumb. I saw in my mailbox something show up from the company that did the repairs, and I was guessing it was a credit card.
So you just threw it out?
And so I shredded it.
Ah.
And I didn't even look at it.
Ah.
And it was a bill.
Wow.
You know, and I just didn't put it together.
That would have tipped you off. Yep.
It would have tipped me off faster. And, you know, it's that classic example of, you know, deleting spam that's really an electronic note to you that you needed to read. I did it in the physical way.
You know, if you delete that email, it's important. They'll just send you another copy, surely.
That's true. Well, now I've learned they'll send new bills, too. And they're overdue. And
they come in yellow envelopes. It's awful.
Exactly.
So you have two kids that are old enough to be on the net all the time now. What are you teaching them? What are you trying to do to instill some sort of security clue to your own progeny?
So the both kids, neither one of them have email. They have the ability to get on net, and it's through, and you'll just love this, it's through a proxy server in which where they go is controlled by me.
As it should be. Dad watches all. That's the way it is in my house.
That's my attitude. I said, you know, I won't look and watch unless I feel worried, but they are not going to get ubiquitous access. And so, in fact, a very funny story. My son, who now is 13, and he's getting to the age where the impact and understanding, he himself, very, very smart kid, and he's beginning to realize the fact that not everybody's nice.
Right.
And so he's getting, just in many respects, not only including the internet, the fact that not everybody's out there to do the right thing.
Yep.
And so he's getting to that age in which his responsibility level is higher, and you know I can start certainly releasing some of the restrictions I put him on today.
Yeah.
So that he can mature into using it with an educated sense.
Well, I'm going to keep a close eye on what you do because my guy's 11. And
yeah, we've talked.
He's on the net now too, but he's pretty restricted right now as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's I think it's the responsibility of parents, and you know my son will be the first to tell you that, you know, the reason I don't have it is because my dad's a security guy, quote unquote.
He probably says that with much derision in his voice.
Yes, oh, he does, and having overheard it at least once.
You try not to laugh.
Exactly, but you know if that's that, I as much as I want to be his friend, I'm his dad first.
Yeah.
And so that's
great.
That's the stance I'm taking.
So one last question. What kind of motorcycle was it that you couldn't buy?
So we went down. Rhonda was looking to buy an FZ1. It's a 1,000-plus cc motorcycle. She was the person who didn't have the right motorcycle for the amount of riding she was doing.
Uh-huh.
And you got to laugh at this, Gary. If you can imagine a sales guy sitting on the other side of me as I say, well, you know, when you go to do the credit check for the fact that you're doing zero financing, it's probably going to get rejected because I'm on credit watch. And I'm sure he's heard that line before.
Yeah. He was probably like, oh, damn, all my time was wasted on this guy.
Exactly. And I said, but it's not for any other reason than that.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I'm sure he's heard that too. And sure enough, it came back. And the funny part about in that day was I had to be at my house in order to receive a phone call from the credit agencies.
Of course.
For them to release the data live to the credit team at the motorcycle place.
And you had to be there to sign the papers.
And I had to be at the motorcycle, exactly, in order to sign some paperwork with Rhonda. Yeah. So that wasn't going to work.
Well, you should have roped in one of those other John Stewarts.
That's right. I clearly did. So it was just textbook. And that was probably one of the hardest experiences because having, you know, known all my life and been institutionalized from day one that, you know, you take care of your money, you protect yourself. And I really, I felt like all of a sudden I had this scarlet letter on me that said, I'm a credit risk.
Yeah.
And it was an awful experience because it, you know, especially being in security in some respects, I took it very personally that was it. And I suddenly felt like I was labeled incorrectly.
A bad guy, all of a sudden.
And I was a bad guy, exactly. Yeah. It was awful. Yeah. But anyway, those days are largely behind us. I hope it never happened again.
Well, thanks very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Gary. I really enjoyed it.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The January-February issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue will also feature long-running departments about building security in, attack trends, and on the horizon. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.